Hello and welcome back to Cooking the Books with me, Jilly Smith, the podcast which takes us through four food moments from the books of our favourite food writers. It's about all of life through the prism of food. And this week we're exploring art, philosophy and food with third generation British Chinese photographer and Instagram superstar Michael Z.
Wuhan is like really good breakfast scene. You know, it is the king of breakfast cuisine in China. The markets are busy, the diversity is there, the food's delicious.
His Symmetry Breakfast account featuring his photographs of symmetrical breakfasts has 667,000 followers. But it's his anthropological eye in his book Breakfast of China that looks beyond the dishes to place, people and home. I began by asking him about an exhibition of his Symmetry Breakfasts at his former employer, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London.
I was invited to participate in an exhibition, Food Bigger Than the Plate. You know, how do we consume food? How do we engage with food? That exhibition was really about process and consumption and waste and ethics of where things come from, and how do we fit in there as producers and consumers of a plate of food. And there's this kind of magical duality of social media where it can bring us together, but it's also incredibly divisive and splitting. And they invited me, also because I was a former colleague that went on to do something in that field, and they felt that connection was very interesting. But also just this kind of aesthetics and, social media is, unless you get up and go and make that dish, the pleasure of the voyeur of just watching someone's life and watching how they behave, and you have this kind of fishbowl. And I think that's also one of the interesting things about social media is that, with such a big following, many people followed us for years, over a decade. And they really feel like they know you. But I obviously don't know them personally. And so, you get approached in the street or in a restaurant and people know every detail, or at least what I've shown them. And I don't even know their name.
But it's art, isn't it? And people do love to follow artists, and they do love to consume as much information as they can possibly get about you. But your actual photographs in Symmetry Breakfast on Instagram are simply, symmetrical photographs of various breakfasts.
This for sure, that whole aesthetic design approach. And I remember working at the V&A doing tours for children about the Jameel Gallery, the Islamic Middle Eastern art galleries, and looking at symmetry with 4-year-olds, but also looking at symmetry with 18-year-olds and symbolism, and it's a testament to, if you do something very small every single day over time, it will build into this amazing mosaic. Yeah. And, there's a kind of an archival recording process there. I mean, even when I scroll back to the very first couple of posts, I think, gosh, how it grew, how it's evolved. And for so many people, it's, how do I start with a social media account? How can I also build a story? How can I also have this amazing, archive library of images? It's like, you just start.
Yes, but I think that what's so interesting is that we do know a lot about your backstory now. But, this new book of yours reveals so much more. That story that you're telling in the book is your backstory. You're third generation. You grew up in Liverpool, surrounded by British Chinese food culture, being a family of restaurateurs that you decided actively not to engage with as a grown up. There are all sorts of decisions there about who you are. To then go to China, to really meet people, and a lot of your photographs in the book are portraits, they're people. How did people engaging with you way back in 2013, 2014 know that all that was there? Did you?
I think I have to also admit there was a sort of conscious decision whilst living in China to kind of step away from the symmetrical plate formats. And I think that was a moment where Instagram started messing around with the algorithms and non-chronological feeds, and and prioritizing new influencers rather than kind of, you know, the older guard of the app. And I just felt, you know what, I don't, you know, I did Signature Breakfast every single day for 7 years without missing a single day. Christmas Day, 1st of January, never missed a day. And it really was, it got heavy, it became burdensome, it became a toll on the relationship that I had with Mark. And, you know, I can't book a morning flight because I need to do the breakfast, and silly things like this, and like stressing out when we were traveling over where I was going to find a place to, you know, that we had some aesthetically interesting food. And then, you know, things, you know, the sort of mentality shifts. It's not about just aesthetics. I want to show reality. I want to show some things are delicious, but maybe not beautiful. And then, you know, and you see how that results in the likes and the engagements and things like this. And then it came, I got kind of a bit, you know, jaded with this obsession with social media food and, you know, sunny side up eggs and you know, colorful smoothies. And then it became this kind of monstrosity of this vulgarness in food that a lot of people started to say, okay, we've had enough of that. And I didn't want to get swept up in that crowd as such. I didn't, you know, like you say, there's more there to me than just lovely colorful fruits and textured tables. And so that was a concern for me. And, you know, my first book, I was really proud of it, but I felt like it was all joy and no body, no substance. And it was nice, and it was my first dip into food writing in that sense. But I didn't really feel it told the real story, you know, and how difficult it is to, you know, from Mark's perspective, to have his husband who's obsessed with taking a picture of his food, and suddenly it became all consuming. And I just thought, okay, this is not going to end well if I pursue it. So let's just park that and see what else I can do with this social media following. And so, you know, in China, you know, there was so much. It's not just breakfast. You're just overwhelmed with volume of information, of recipes, of people, of expression, all these things around food. And, you know, I just kind of took a mild break and just documented that story. And that was enormously popular when I was posting, you know, villages in China and this is somewhere new, that those stories were, people couldn't get enough.
Of course, because people want real stories, don't they? The thing that really struck me was that actually most people in China don't have kitchens. Most people will eat out.
Well, I wouldn't say they don't have kitchens. Kitchens as we have them in the West are very, very different. So most Chinese people don't have an oven. Most Chinese people don't have a freezer. They have, you know, plenty of countertop appliances, rice cookers, steamers, wok. Very popular to have an air fryer today. Most people just have two gas burners. And for certain, in the kind of older former French concession of Shanghai, people will have a shared kitchen. That's sort of dying out, but still, you know, it's a hangover from a period of, you have to appreciate that there was a time in Shanghai and also all the mega cities where there were no tower blocks. You know, the density at a low level was crazy. And, you know, people's working schedules meant that they worked long hours. And it's not that people don't have kitchens because it's cheaper and easier just to go out.
But it's not that everyone's kind of very showy and they do have to compete with each other, but they are quite humble stalls.
I mean, well, you've got to appreciate also the density of Chinese cities is in the same, in a way that competition in a Western sense, you know, some guy opened next to me that serves the same thing, that might be a problem. In London or Wuhan, but in China, you know, you could have a whole street of the same dish and they would all be full. So competition doesn't run in the same problem. It's not the same problem in that sense. But you know, I remember when we lived in central Shanghai, we'd walk out the door and on the opposite corner of the crossroads that we lived on, there was a large wet market. And you know, inside this wet market, there's people making fresh dumplings. You can buy the fresh noodles, fresh made tofu, vegetables, you know, live fish. And that's maybe every other junction is a market like this. I remember on the junction, we lived on those two or three jianbing makers. And you know, if you got up early enough, there was a furniture shop selling, you know, small stools and tables. But between kind of 4 and 6 a.m., it was a vegetable shop. And they would just lay out the plastic tarpaulin on the floor, and the farmers would come with their crop of that day. And all the kind of, you know, the grannies would buy their vegetables from him rather than from the bigger market across the street. And then, you know, at the end of the road, there was a luxury Western mall that has luxury Western style supermarket chains from either from Japan or from Hong Kong or Taiwan, and that would sell, you know, organic plastic wrap produce and French cheeses and stuff. And then, you know, on the way to that mall, there's maybe 6 or 7 coffee shops all specializing in different styles, second wave, third wave, pour over Chinese beans, African beans, South American beans, you know, of every different kind of expression of style or price point. You know, you could go and buy a coffee from a 7-Eleven convenience store for 20p, 30p, or you could go to a much fancier place and get something with the same price you would in London, £3.50, £4. There's a real spectrum. And I think what's so interesting about China, especially the breakfast time, is that there's a lot of transparency with what do you see? You know, you see the guy making the dough and making the noodles in front of you. There's that. It's about theater, but it's also about kind of honesty. Like, we're not doing anything dodgy. And these spaces are very small. You can't have a separate kitchen from the streets. You know, it's there because they don't have an alternative. It's not necessarily, oh, we're trying to put this on show like a cocktail bar, and we're just showing you the pour. But actually, the prep is done earlier. This is it. this space is the whole thing.
Because as a sort of an anthropological photographer, this is absolutely heaven. And you know, let's go into your first food moment. You talk about the wet markets, and I suppose what most people would think about wet markets is Wuhan.
Yes.
And your first food moment takes us directly to Wuhan through the eyes of a lovely couple. Tell us that story.
So they found this couple online. They were, you know, consistently ranked one of the best restaurants in Wuhan for rogan mian, which is the hot dry noodle of Wuhan. Hot because of the spicy, dry because there's no soup. Their little shop in this kind of neighborhood that wasn't central at all, and, you know, kind of got there towards the end of the service, like 11 o'clock in the morning, kind of 12-ish. And they're kind of, you know, finishing up last orders and cleaning and stuff like this. And, you know, and you just get into a conversation with them. And it's interesting because the man in the portrait, he actually had his left arm amputated. And I never asked him why, but he would stand behind his wife in a way to cover that up. So that portrait of him in the introduction, he's obviously very nervous about, you know, being seen as disabled. And you know, his story was really very kind of, there's a lot of melancholy and a lot of sadness there. And I think that was one of the, you know, after finishing the book and kind of going over this overview, is that was the kind of question that lingered over most of these people who were, you know, small proprietors, that their future was uncertain for many reasons. And he, you know, he said that he and his wife were very beautiful when they were young, but this business makes you old. It was a year after COVID broke out. I think it was May 2021. You know, the world is still going through lockdowns at this point. And I'm in Wuhan, and he's telling me about how they dealt with, you know, delivering medicines to their elderly neighbors, and they had no idea what was going to happen. And, you know, he was very kind of philosophical about the situation.
They were quite apologetic as well, weren't they? They felt that the world blamed Wuhan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a city that is, you know, it is the king of breakfast cuisine in China. That's really, Wuhan is like really good breakfast scene. You know, the markets are busy, the diversity is there, the food is delicious. They have a fully evolved menu of items of choice. And Wuhan is actually, you know, they also have a colonial era riverfront, these kind of grand neoclassical buildings. It's a very chic city. You know, it has very good university. It's a very prosperous province. You know, it's a nice city. This is what's so interesting about Wuhan, is that people, you know, never heard of this place before. Yeah.
Your second food moment takes us out of Wuhan. The whole book takes us across the country through, obviously, all the different regional Chinese breakfasts. Xinjiang is where we go to meet your friend Atina's aunt, who makes a business out of hand-making. Naizipi, is that how you pronounce it?
Naizipi.
Naizipi. Milk skin, freezed and shipped to Shanghai. What? Tell me about this. What were you trying to do with this particular food moment?
You know, a lot of the time when you're... It's about that. For here, it was about the communication, because Atina's aunt, she didn't speak Mandarin or English. She spoke Shibonese and Kazakh. And, you know, trying to understand... You know, the sort of world someone lives in, and through gesture, through kind of observation, and without making a judgment, without having words to kind of converse. And, you know, she was just the loveliest, kindest person, without actually being able to say directly to her, you know, this is a really wonderful experience. Thank you so much for sharing this with me. You know, it's just the good nature of certain people, even without... you know, the formalities of, like, I'm going to come and film you today and I want to watch you, and don't mind me. And just that kind of, like, natural energy you can have with certain people. But also just how much of on a fringe people live, and the sort of life they lead, and how that can basically now through modern food networks can be connected to this global metropolis.
You're looking at all this through your photographer's eyes first, aren't you? It is the portrait of her. Is that the way that you see everything?
I definitely start with the images. You know, it's not necessarily that, you know, images have to be exciting, but I have some beautiful photos from her house and from the whole experience and all the video, and, you know, there's so much there that doesn't go into the book through because of page space and things like this, but just to kind of be there in this kind of space and take pictures of the surroundings. And, you know, I have a picture of a clock on the wall that is the shape of a teddy bear, and just the color choices she had and the way the light comes in the space and how it changed through the day was really kind of how do I convey that place and that sense of, like, her home through photography, through you know, what's selected and the video, because that's one of the great recipes in the book that has the QR code with the video. You see this very interesting process that, you know, has parallels with cultures from Turkey all the way to Kazakhstan to Western China, and just to kind of have that moment with her. And I think this photography is still a beautiful media, even though obviously video can be more expressive, it can explain more. But, you know, just that portrait of her with her dish, with that smile, I love that picture.
Yeah, I do too. It's beautiful. Your third food moment, so you take us on a 4-hour drive into the mountains outside Chengdu, where we meet Jing Gao, who has created the Fly Baijing chili crisp. And the reason that you want to talk about this is actually because it's about an organic, artisanal, and undoubtedly Chinese product that you think we can add to food in the way that people used to add MSG. But MSG was a game changer in Chinese food. And you talk about it as the democratization of flavor.
Well, it came in at a time and a place where it revolutionized low-quality ingredients. And I think that's the crux of what the association that we have today. You know, we still in the West have this overarching stereotype that if you eat poor quality food, you're somehow morally a bad person, and that's your fault. You make that choice. And if you're wealthy and you eat organic and go to, you know, Whole Foods and Erewhon and Pastures, you're somehow better. And I feel that with China, you know, you have a period of history, you know, post-revolutionary agriculture policy failing, famine, lack of availability, you know, poor management of the land. And, you know, people still wanted to have tasty food. If you use MSG creatively, if you use MSG selectively and with intelligence, it's just another ingredient. Now, as the kind of perceptions of in China, the quality is increasing so drastically, organic produce. You know, I think the total amount of farmed organic land in China is about the size of the Republic of Ireland. You know, when I last checked, they were the fourth largest producer of organic food in the world. You know, there is a slow shift away from antibiotic use towards people being concerned about where that chicken's come from. And so it's not necessarily that they're rejecting MSG, it's just that they're no longer needing to use it as much as they did. The food tastes better today. And I think that's where the argument is getting maybe missed, is that there's nothing inherently wrong with MSG at all. And all the studies show that it has no effect, no harm, no impact at all. So, you know, those stereotypes need to kind of disappear. But MSG, you know, if you have great quality ingredients, you don't really need it.
Your fourth food moment is actually taking you right back to the beginning. The book is dedicated to your grandfather, who was the lord of Chinese food in Liverpool from the 1950s, 60s, 70s. I mean, he had every single Chinese emporium, didn't he? Tell me what that felt like growing up with that kind of dynasty.
I took so many things for granted. I also was completely clueless about many things. You have this kind of like blinkered childhood worldview where you just take so much for granted. You don't really ask too many questions. You just, this is what's on the table. This is what we eat as people. It didn't really occur to me until much older. I think it was one of the first times I went to Shanghai. I asked my father's cousin, oh, couldn't we get some char siu baos? And she says to me, they're not from this region. They're from Guangdong. I was like, oh, why did Granddad eat them all the time? He loved them. And he just picked that up on his travels on merchant shipping. And he was, you know, and I just thought that's what they ate in Shanghai. You know, because you don't, you're not a seven-year-old going, oh, is this authentic? Is this authentic? You know, you just don't do that, especially not at the family dinner table. You know, I wish I'd taken more pictures. I wish I'd asked more questions. I wish I had more things I knew about him, knew about the restaurants. But I think he's this quite enigmatic figure. And part of the allure of, you know, going to China, going to his house where he was born and the shrine of the family is partly to understand more who this guy was and his motivations and what pushed him and you know, the world at the time and, you know, incredible upheaval during the war, revolution, Japanese invasion. And, you know, you can either portray him as a hero or just as an opportunist. And so, you know, for him, trying to understand more about him and basically the opportunity for him to open restaurants in Liverpool was, you know, was he trying to educate the British public on Chinese food? Absolutely not. He just needed to have an income.
It's been called third culture, and particularly by food writers, you know, people who are contemplating who they are through their food history, bringing together the food from their ancestors through their family line to where they are now. Many of them have chosen all sorts of different ways of living. And third culture seems to be where you can make it up. You can be who you really are. Is that how you feel?
No. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of very good, positive, one-line inspirational quotes, you know, when people say, oh, when I eat the food of a culture, it helps me understand them. I think it's just a bit shallow. And, you know, at some point, I feel that people take their own story and extrapolate too much.
You've done the book. You've spent 10 years talking to hundreds of thousands of people about who you are as a third generation British Chinese person living all over the world, really engaging with so much of what you see through your British Chinese photographer eyes. What do you know now about who you are that you didn't know when you started this journey?
I think for me, sometimes the enigma of and the mystery of sometimes your own personality is maybe sometimes best unexplored. the unknown and the kind of undiscovered is where those adventures are, whether it's food or person or individual storytelling. If we discover everything, what's there to say?
Thanks for listening. Do head over to my Substack to try out the Wuhan hot dry noodles from one of Michael's food moments. And I'll see you next week.